This is the award-winning official theme song of the Vancouver Whistler 2010 Olympic Games. It's called the official theme song of the Vancouver Whistler 2010 Olympic Games. The dead children were worth it. British Columbia is super proud to sing this welcome song. For these wonderful Winter Olympic Games we've awaited for so long. All you terrific foreign visitors, we're so glad that you are here. For this $10 billion two-week party that we're putting on this year. Of course, the credit goes to the government when they approve the $40 billion. They cost cut out the office that investigates children's deaths. And the dead, dead children were worth it. The dead, dead children were worth it. Dead, dead children were worth it. The Vancouver Whistler Olympic Games. In a suburban warehouse somewhere sits all 700 files.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
This is John, your philosopher, squeaky historian.
I'm the special guest, Dave, and I'm a multi-purpose cultural pundit.
I'm just Daniel.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist and late introducer of special guests. Introducing our special guest and live in the studio with us today is Dave Olson, also known as Uncle Weed on Twitter. And he's a frequent guest of the Crazy Canucks podcast and recently appointed community manager of Hootsuite. Welcome.
Indeed. Thanks. It's great to be here. I'm a big fan of the show, guys. I'll, you know, being a humanities guy, I'll try to stay up with the scientific knowledge in here, but if steam starts coming from my ears, just give me a beverage and I'll be all right.
Well, no worries about that. Apparently there's two historians here now.
Yeah, sorry. Did I say squeaky historian?
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, okay. So we're starting off to a great special one-hour episode. Any great science things, anyone?
I think first we should talk about the theme song we just played.
Oh,
YouTube lied to us. They said that was the official theme song.
Yes, yeah. If you Google official Vancouver Olympics 2010 theme song in YouTube, you will find this song by,
Jeff Berner. I'm a big fan of his. He's like a renegade accordion. Well, obviously he's an accordion player, but the guy's kind of Frank Sinatra with an accordion on stage. He's always got a cocktail in one hand for between songs, and, well, it inspires fine songwriting like that, apparently.
Very classy.
Well, speaking of classy, What do people think of skeptics, Rob?
Oh, yes. Over the past couple of weeks, there's this thing going on Twitter called the Scotty Awards, which is basically just this popularity contest of people who can convince most of their followers to vote for them. And P.Z. Myers of Pharyngula found out that there was a health category and that a lot of really quacky doctors were high up in the... So he, as he normally does, asked people to game the poll and vote up everything else that was, you know, more scientifically based. Now, Mike Adams, the incredibly cranky quack who runs Natural Health News, got mad about this. He is apparently completely outraged at being bumped out of the top five of the Scotty Awards. And as P.Z. Meyer says on his blog, look, guy, it's an internet award for tweeting. Take the big picture, recognize that as far as significance goes, it's a bit like finding an especially large and fluffy bit of belly button lint. Of course, he is a homeopath. Maybe to him, a Twitter award is like an infinitely diluted Nobel Prize, and is especially potent. Now, the really interesting thing about this is that Mike Adams posted this hilarious screed on his blog, where he lists off all the things that skeptics supposedly believe. And here's a selection of some of them to warm us up. Skeptics believe that all vaccines are safe and effective, even if they've never been tested, and all people should be vaccinated, even against their will, and that there is no limit to the number of vaccines a person can be safely given. So injecting all children with, for example, 900 vaccines all at the same time is believed to be perfectly safe and good for your health.
What about performing chiropractic adjustments on children?
That's a little creepy. Actually, I think Penn and Teller
covered that. Yes, that's where I got it from.
Bullshit. Yes. Skeptics believe that many six-month-old infants need antidepressant drugs. In fact, they believe that people of all ages can be safely given an unlimited number of drugs all at the same time. Antidepressants, cholesterol drugs, blood pressure drugs, diabetes drugs, anti-anxiety drugs, sleeping drugs, and more simultaneously.
That's a lot of drugs.
Where do I get on that testing program?
Sounds fun.
Skeptics believe that pregnancy is a disease and childbirth is a medical crisis.
I think this guy's watched Aliens too many times.
Skeptics believe there is no such thing as human consciousness. They do not believe in the mind, only in the physical brain. In fact, skeptics believe that they themselves are mindless automatons who have no free will, no soul, and no consciousness whatsoever. Well, I'm not think that we have a soul, but fairly certain I'm conscious.
Don't you, like, you know, specialize in brains or something like that?
Don't bug him. It's not like he has a choice in saying what he's saying.
He's just an automaton. No free will.
Well, I do believe that I'm a non-deterministic biological robot.
Well, there you go.
But that's not like I have any choice in the matter. And here's one last one for the road. Skeptics believe that dead foods have exactly the same nutritional properties as living foods. Hilarious. That last hilarious was from Mike Adams himself.
Wait, I'm kind of confused. Dead foods? Like everything we eat, pretty much?
Well, no, not things like miso and beer and, you know, things that have, like, the yeasty cultures grown in them.
Okay, maybe so that's just yogurts.
Drink lots of beer.
Yeah, yogurts. See, there's where I'm coming in with my cultural punditry. Yeah. Thank you, Al. Be here.
Oh, get out. Wah, wah, you're wah. Done.
Sad trombone.
Okay. So, well, that concludes our festivities for the day.
Well, on to some serious business. So maybe you might have heard, I don't know, in some newspaper somewhere, that Vancouver is hosting the Olympics.
What?
And a couple of weeks, actually.
I was not informed of this.
I had no idea.
I haven't seen anything like that around town.
Yeah.
When did we decide this?
Apparently, like, years ago, but I don't know. There is actually a few concerns. Believe it or not, people are a little... they're not too sure about this sort of thing.
I have read of a few things, like everything from as minor as the temporary irritation of some road closures and an influx of tourists to complete economic collapse and the creation of a police state in Vancouver.
You know, I'm reminded of a fellow, I think you guys have heard of him, named Carl Sagan. He said something about extraordinary claims. What was that? Extraordinary claims requires something.
Extraordinary evidence.
Ooh.
So today's show is all going to be about looking at the experiences of people and their evidence they can provide for and against all these claims that are being made about the Olympics and their effect on Vancouver.
So why don't we start off with something, I guess the most controversial issue, that's civil rights. Now, there's been a lot of claims about civil rights. Maybe our guest can talk a bit about civil rights here. What are some of the issues that people are cautioning about that the Olympics might be affecting?
Well, there's a lot of people really concerned about a few things that seem that have come out publicly from the Integrated Security Unit, from VANOC, from IOC, that seem really contrary to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Things like non-celebratory signage, and where you can and can't protest, what you can and can't have on a T-shirt. But really, there's this big different shades of gray in this whole thing. But it really starts with a few years ago when Vancouver won the bid. There's a few contingencies that come with that. One, the city of Vancouver had to sign a host city agreement, which included a litany of bylaws, which are just now sort of surfacing now, as well as the federal government passed specific legislation to protect will go beyond protecting IOC's intellectual property and the laundry list of terms that are now protected for a temporary basis through, you know, leading up and after the games, include words like winter and games and 2010. And so there's a lot of confusion about, like, well, does the IOC trump the Canadian rights and freedoms? And this also came to into conversation with the court case about the women's ski jumpers. Should women have a right to ski jump in the Olympics? And I've seen the ski jumps. Anyone who wants to jump off of that, regardless of gender, should be, knock yourself out. But I think there's a lot of Canadians that are really concerned and confused because there's this mix-up and hierarchy of what's more important, these city bylaws, these provincial laws that have come out about forced removal of homelessness with the intellectual property, and then with these different security apparati, it's kind of having different opinions about what will be enforced and what won't be enforced, because there's the Integrated Security Unit, which is a consortium of law enforcement. There's the Vancouver Police Department, and they're kind of saying a little bit different stuff, as well as what you hear from VANOC. So, you know, you end up with this big gray area. And as part of my research, you know, I've spoken to everyone from Dave Eby, the superstar lawyer from BC Civil Liberties Association, to city council members, to people from VANOC, and shock and surprise, everyone gives a slightly different answer. I've also had conversations with the ISU, and they're playing, oh, no, it's everything's going to be fine. We'll lull you into submission. So there really is no answer, and there is no clear thing. But what is clear is over the next 2 to 3 weeks, there's going to be a tremendous amount of experiments to see how far we as citizens or human beings can go to express ourselves, to assemble. Like, for example, these zones out front of the inside the venues, you're bound by the conditions on the ticket. You buy a ticket to go in, you got to do what it says on the back of the ticket because that's private property. However, the Olympics controls all this land around the venue. So it's not just going into the hockey rink. It's all the area around it. You're going to go through security. And once you're through that security threshold, you're in. And so you can't take things in there. You can't express yourself. You can't have a T-shirt that says Free Tibet on it. You can't have a sign that says anything but go country that I'm cheering for that's participating in this event. So you're going to see a lot of really creative protests, as well as, I think, a fair amount of unwitting conflict that results from these murky laws.
So I guess there's definitely then there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of people basically just don't know what's going to be they're going to be arrested for. They don't know what they're going to get in trouble for, essentially, is what you're saying.
I know, like, when I was looking around for, like, what exactly security is up to, and The big thing, the news ticket out there that everyone talks about is security is going to cost like at least $900 million, probably closer to $1 billion. But when $1 billion of taxpayer money is being spent, like, I think we should have some right of knowing what it's being spent on. And there's very little out there other than very broad categories. It's just I couldn't find anything about, like, what security is doing.
No, absolutely. Their budget is completely opaque, has not been shared at all. In fact, and that's the case with a lot of the different components of the Olympic budget, but certainly the onerous security budget that will be over $1 billion. There's just no information. They do the, if you're not with us, you're with the boogeyman thing where it's like, oh, if we tell you what we're spending the money on, then the terrorists will know, and they'll know exactly what to do and that kind of thing. But it's important to remember, I went to the Salt Lake City Winter Olympics in 2002, and this was 3 months after that 9/11 incident that happened. And Utah, you know, if you haven't heard, is a rather conservative place. They're really into their law enforcement and
Mormonism.
They spent just over $200 million on security, and that was a doubled budget right after 9/11. They're like, oh, we better bring in all the cops from Idaho as well. And when we're quadrupling, and I'm no economist here, but I think that's higher than the rate of inflation. When we're out-conservating and out-uptighting Utah, something's really wrong and certainly not reflective of the Vancouver that I know and love.
Well, I even heard the other day that we're spending 10 times as much as they spent on the Beijing Olympics and like 5 times as much as they spent on like G20s. It's a horrible amount. But didn't they promise in the beginning it was only supposed to be like $178 million?
Yeah, that was the original thing. Yeah. They're going to recruit Cub Scouts to do it, actually, and they're going to give them badges. Yeah.
That's nice for them, I suppose.
They can tie knots.
Knots are good, yeah.
But it's really their, it's not just the local police, obviously. They're bringing in police from all over Canada, RCMP from all over Canada. Plus, there's all this stuff that's really hard to find out about, but the U.S. government and U.S. military has put a put a little HQ near the Bellingham Airport. And with all these activities, in fact, today there was helicopters circling around downtown, and they've been doing all these tests and all this stuff and all these security drills, and it seems a little bit like, really, it's like Wile E. Coyote trying to catch the Roadrunner, it seems like to me.
I know out of the $900 million they're saying they're spending, they are saying they're going to give like $212 million to military-related things.
What?
And here's the crazy thing. That's more than the original entire budget for security. But the sheer fact is, like, Canada, we have police for a reason. They're supposed to handle internal security. The military, like,
they're supposed to handle external security,
right? What they're trained to do is kill people, quite frankly. They're trained to, like, defend us from external threats, and it's really bad when you have them, like, roaming around. Like, I think they're mostly going to be used for, like, sort of backcountry stuff from what I've heard. But once again, there's very little information on anything of what they're using. But, like, $200 million to the military? Like, shouldn't we be using civilian police officers at the very least?
Well, don't be surprised either. I noticed just by UBC, I was taking the 44 bus, and there were a whole bunch of trailers and army vehicles in with those trailers. And
Are you sure it wasn't a movie?
No, I was sure it wasn't those kind of trailers, because we know the difference. These were cheap trailers. They weren't the movie star trailers.
Now, you even see Canadian Forces police cruisers driving around downtown now. And then besides all the integrated security unit with the military and the RCMP and these foreign apparatchi, there's also this group of legal observers that will be observing these things going on in the pedestrian zones, which begat the program, the Legal Observers program, because there's going to be all these trained, basically volunteers, people who signed up to be volunteers are going to be out there being the, I'm going to tell on you
because
you
have keeping an eye on
you
each other.
And your Palestine shirt can't come in.
Well, one of the scariest things, actually, I think, with that are the green shirts. I mean, if everyone noticed the green shirts that have suddenly shown up with all the SkyTrain, the new SkyTrain. Yeah. You know, they first were there sort of to help, and now
I used to be able to get so many free rides, and now
dang it.
Well, why don't we take a quick break, and we'll be back with some more on Radio Free Thinker.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
LiveBand.com is Vancouver's most reputable, community-driven concert calendar. New shows are listed daily by the city's most prominent promoters, but also by you. The musicians and fans were the driving force of our local music scene. LiveBand.com's listings are different because they're personalized. They're integrated with local music directories that are constantly updated by the bands, musicians, and businesses who refer to them as they pick locations and lineups for their newest upcoming shows. And no one's barred from contributing, since we all know fans know more about the players than anyone. So visit livemusicvancouver.com for the latest major and independent event listings. And while you're at it, check out our archives and discover how closely we all work together in this community, putting on the shows you love.
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. We're talking about the Olympics and some of the claims that are going on about whether or not we're descending into a police state.
Hold it, Ethan, could you move a little bit to the right? Yeah, no, I just want to make sure you're in the camera's light so that we can get a good shot of your face, and the facial recognition will... Oh, Ethan, were you or have you ever been a communist?
I think that's you.
You don't have to answer that, so, but will we?
So for this episode, I decided to look into the sort of evidence behind CCTV cameras to see whether there's actually sort of any decent evidence that they either apprehend criminals afterwards or more specifically prevent crimes in the first place. Obviously, I don't think there's very much about terrorism specifically, but one only has to logically think about it. If a terrorist is going to blow themselves up, how is a camera going to stop them? But, it just seems completely logical to me. But more on, like, just general crimes and stuff is, like, what I've looked at. And so I also sort of, I have three arguments against CCTV cameras. The first one is what I like to call sort of a principled argument, the civil liberties argument, which, I mean, most of the show is going to be about that, so I'll come back to that later. And it's not as much of a skeptical thing.
So it's not really your first argument. It's
well, it's to me, it's my most important argument, because the other two eventually, as technology improves, might not be as good arguments. But I'll get into them for now. There's sort of the effectiveness argument. There's just no evidence that CCTV cameras seem to really do much.
As I understand it, there's been a lot of studies done on that very topic, especially in the UK, where they have a ton of cameras. And there was a recent study that sort of found that it didn't really help, except in very specific circumstances.
Yeah, in the UK, there was a study done by Professor Martin Gill. It was done in tandem with a department of the government, so this isn't, like, I mean, it's from their own internal thing. So, if anything, it's probably going to be biased towards them. But even they only found, or they looked at 13 different systems across the UK, and they found controls nearby, like regional similarities, close to the same sort of crime rate beforehand, that didn't get these camera systems. And then so they compared them to see whether crime rates were actually going down. And of these 13 systems, only two of them had any statistically relevant reduction in crime. And of one of those cases, there was a confounding variable, I think a separate police initiative that might have caused that. So,
or at least a very vengeful judge.
Yes. Someone was angry there.
Or Batman.
Could be Batman. Anyways, so basically one out of 13 places showed a reduction in crime. And it wasn't a huge one. It wasn't like crime stopped. It was a little bit. And they also found that there's sort of two major types of crime. There's impulsive crimes, which is sort of like drunken brawls, or like someone sees like an opportunity to easily steal someone's purse, that kind of thing. They found that cameras do almost nothing to stop those, because when people do that, they're not gonna like be thinking, oh, is there a camera around? They found that the only time it really does anything is against premeditated crimes. So that's crimes like car theft or burglary of houses.
Well, that would make sense if you know, they work in places like parking lots and stuff like that. That's where you'd expect to find them, and where you'd probably find them, they work best.
That's exactly what they found. They found the ones that did the most were in parking lots, especially ones that had only a few entrances, because you can put a couple cameras at every entrance, and people know they're getting photographed coming in. And, I mean, the thing with car parking lots is, quite frankly, like, you don't really need the sort of government to be imposing these. Like, the private companies that generally own these can put them up, and then it's less likely that there's going to be any like severe abuse of them.
Obviously I'm going to disagree on that aspect of it. It's not a big thing, but I'd much rather have government regulations than some weirdo in the closet who put up some cameras and who knows what he's doing with them. But Daniel, you're missing the big issue. It's terrorism. The terrorists are going to get us, Daniel. I mean, didn't the CCTV cameras help London in tracking down their terrorists?
They got a video to put on YouTube of the explosion. I know that's terrible to say, but at the same time, like, if someone is going to be a suicide bomber, what is a camera going to do? Like, a fence is going to do more. Screening is going to do more. Whether you like screening or not, like, at least it has sort of some logical, like, reason for it.
Given that impulsive crimes aren't really affected by surveillance systems, what does this mean for the massive amounts of cameras and audio recording equipment that have been deployed on our public transit systems, for example? Those are supposedly there to prevent people from attacking other people on the bus or bothering the bus driver or things like that, which, as we've seen in the study, those seem like impulsive crimes that wouldn't be affected. So what's going to happen with that information?
I would think, though, that the benefit with those ones would be more for getting an arrest, or not getting an arrest, getting a conviction, actually.
Well, there, you could make an argument that it's not quite as impulsive when you're going on a bus. Like, you know ahead of time you're going without fare, and that a bus driver is probably not going to let you on. So
plan on assaulting a bus driver, you have that in your head. You know, but if I get stopped, I'm beating this guy up.
See, the thing about the cameras on buses is they aren't actively monitored, which is one like big reason aren't so, but am I wrong here?
It's the panopticon.
The one on the buses aren't. I don't know about SkyTrain cameras, they probably are, but the ones on the buses aren't. So it's only if there's an incident, then they can go back and look at the tape to hopefully help get an arrest. But see, even with that, in the UK, there's a detective chief inspector named Mick Neville who runs sort of their camera program all across the UK. And here's a quote from him about the camera operations. It's been an utter fiasco. only 3% of crimes...
Seems very confident.
Yeah, were solved by them. And this is in the UK where there's a CCTV camera for one out of every 14 people. That's just, like, there's millions. It's a billion over, I think it's like a $5 billion a year business there.
Hmm.
In like the US, you always hear about like the military industrial complex. In the UK, they have like their security industrial complex. It's just become so ingrained in the political structure now that it's going to be really hard to stop. But
it's kind of surreal when you're walking around, you know, the old London town, you have all these classic buildings with these little cyclops eyes on them everywhere. And they are just everywhere. You know, you just want to duck in an alley for a second. Everywhere. But, you know, I think what would be really interesting, I would feel a lot more comfortable with CC cameras if they were publicly viewable by everyone. And probably they'd end up being more effective that way if you had all these people, all these, you know, the grandmas who look out the window of what the meddling kids are doing on the street all day. If you had them looking at the cameras and they could be like, there's somebody on the harassing that bus driver. And what happens with all these, all the tapes or whatever media they're backing it up on? Where does all this stuff live? How long is it kept for? Does it just disappear after a week? Or is it held on to forever?
I mean, what can it be used for is another thing. Like, if there is no crime and someone is watching for something completely unrelated and notices something else happening on the tape, is that admittable in court? Can it be used to launch another investigation? Who knows?
What we really need is a case to come to light so we can actually see what actually happens. We need this to go before a judge and see, so what do they use as evidence?
You hear that, listeners of Radio Free Thinkers?
Commit a crime so we can find out what happens to you.
It'll be your opportunity to be a guest on Radio Free Thinkers.
It's worth the
after you get out of prison.
I think that there's no doubt that something will come out of all the Olympics and there'll be some kind of trial, but even going down to watch the fireworks downtown Vancouver last summer, I noticed the police up on rooftops with with video cameras on tripods, which is kind of a little bit of a precursor for this kind of tomfoolery. But then what happens at the end of the games when these cameras that are here just for the terrorists, for the Olympics and all this, they're given to the city, and are they just going to vanish? Will they be taken down? What's the economic argument of operating them and running them versus saying, well, thanks for the gift, we're going to give them away, or thanks for the gift, we're going to make them into tourist webcams and point them out to scenic views of English Bay instead of pointing on citizens?
That would be a really, really good idea.
That's a good idea. Much better than spying on us.
But I think one of the things, too, and I think I'm sure the Vancouver Police Department thinks of this, I mean, from previous economic riots and that you have, I mean, they had it in Copenhagen and all that, one of the things they love the video cameras for isn't for police protection, isn't even for terrorists, but they want to know who are the subversives or the rabble-rousers.
There is sort of an idea that there's a worry that all the surveillance equipment is going to be used to pick out the people that don't support the Olympics and then go and bother them. I mean, there was some bylaw or something they tried to pass where they could, you know, find out who anti-Olympic protesters are, come into their homes and take away their signs.
Yes. It's a bylaw, and it kind of got a little bit conflated in the news about what you could do. And again, this is where you had different opinions from ISU and from VPD. It was a city bylaw about these pedestrian zones, these pedestrian corridors, and within those zones, which is where people live, these are regular neighborhoods that you can't have non-celebratory signs. And but there is still a waiting period before they can come in. They just can't kick down your door. But there's definitely some evasive steps that they can take to make sure you take down that sign. But it's like when they say non-celebratory, what does that mean? But I think the most interesting response I've seen to that is there's a group that sent out a press release anonymously saying to bring just protest with a plain white sign. Take it into events, hang it from your windows, just a plain white sign saying this is how we feel about our right to speak out. Being taken away from us.
Yeah, like I actually looked up that bill. It's the 2009 Miscellaneous Statutes Amendment Act of 2009. It's got a very catchy name. And I kind of, I read the first sort of section, and it does sound pretty malicious, but then when you read sort of the subsections, it's kind of like, okay, well, they pretty much just defang their own law. Like you said, they need to have written consent to enter, they have to give you 24 hours notice, they have to have a warrant, they have to be nice to you, they can't, you know, beat you up or anything.
Well, as we've seen, the VPD doesn't really handle that last part very well.
Yeah, hopefully that'll be done by Bannock group.
Do they have to have written permission and a warrant? Because a warrant is all about not having permission.
What the bill said, they must have a warrant under the act with that this bill or whatever bylaw is. So they must have a warrant from this. They need to have written notice to the owner 24 hours. So they have to send you a letter saying, we're going to come to your house
hide all your stuff.
Thursday. Which essentially is what you're going to do. You're going to go hide all your stuff. So I don't really... if this is designed to go into your house and terrorize someone, it's doing a very poor job of doing that because you're giving them notice.
Yeah. So I don't think it's for terrorism. It's just... And what the Olympics keep saying in the city when it all kind of blew up in the media said is they're really more concerned about ambush marketing and guerrilla marketing and having... attended some Olympic events, there's all these carpet bagging, for lack of a better term, companies that come along because there's one official sponsor for each thing, the Coke and McDonald's type thing. And so the other companies will come and hire a street team, or they'll come and rent the place right across the street and hang big banners on it and stuff like that.
Well, we'll get a bunch of people to sit in the stands wearing t-shirts.
Yeah. And so that kind of stuff is just an absolute no-go. And the IOC have gotten incredibly good at protecting that kind of stuff for their sponsors, which is a little bit distasteful to say the least. Anyway, you slice it, especially since, you know, this is our neighborhood and this is where we live and express ourselves on a day-to-day basis.
Well, actually, and doesn't that actually point maybe to this is where a lot of the security is for? It's not for personal protection, but economic protection.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. No doubt about it. And the terrorism boogeyman is just the front for it.
Bannock and IOC are doing a lot to protect their own trademarks as well. I mean, there was something in the news lately, all over, about how if you take pictures of anything that has like the Olympic logo or any Olympic venue and put it up on the internet and there's a possibility of it being used commercially, they can take it down.
Yeah, there was a big story about that. A photographer out of Australia had licensed, put his pictures from the London Games. Someone, a book publisher in London, grabbed one of his pictures, used it commercially without his permission. IOC sent him a takedown notice, and he said, hey, hold on, I've done nothing wrong. And it went back and forth, and he kept everything very public and very polite, but to see the way that they track it down. And then on Vanock's website, they have a whole dossier about all the things that, you know, they're educational materials for shopkeepers about what they can and can't say. You can't have a sign that says winter sporting event sale or, you know, all these terms again that they really go in and protect with, well, significant vigor to say the least. But, I mean, make no mistake about it. There is a chance that there are people who want to come commit terrorist acts, but there's no doubt that the IOC is in this for the money, and they have a great thing going. They don't really pay for too much. The cities, the Olympic associations in each country, the sponsors pick up the tab, and IOC takes on the gravy.
Yeah, and I think the really beneficial part for the IOC is that basically Vanock is basically they have to enforce the IOC's brand. If Vanock fails, the IOC can come in and sue them.
Yeah.
So it definitely is a nice racket for them. But, I mean, getting onto the topic of sort of brand protection, you know, I have to ask, though, but isn't that pretty standard if you went into, like, you know, a grocery store or, Sears and started taking pictures of their signs?
That's one of the differences. I mean, like, for example, Olympic Pizza had to change their name.
Yeah. But again, the IOC owns that trademark way before Olympic Pizza did, though, right?
Well, okay, think of it this way. Like, if around the Super Bowl time, like, every company wants to advertise things about the Super Bowl. Like, you'll get, like, TV ads saying, like, oh, you gotta get one for the big game.
Yeah.
And rather than saying a Super Bowl, because if they said that, they'd have to be licensed. Yeah. But under, like, trademark law, like, that is perfectly legal, even though everyone knows what you're talking about. I don't see how winter games or, like, if you said, like, the big event here, you'd probably get sued. I just don't understand how this, like, could be legal, because
the federal legislation. And it's there. They signed it into law, and it's a list. And you look at it, and you'll just go, are you kidding me?
See, here's my bet, though. I bet, like, if someone actually took that to court and it eventually would make its way to the Supreme Court of Canada, I bet you they'd overturn it. Not that it matters, though, because it just has to last through the games. But it's these kind of things that they can do, like, pass laws that they know won't pass, like, the charter test.
Well, let's not get into conspiracy theories. I mean, Harper proroguing Parliament, everyone's saying one of the reasons why he did that is he wants to prevent any government action from the Olympics.
Now, there's a to go back to the Olympic piece, is that the place on Denman that you're talking about? There's a place on Denman, Olympic. It's a Greek restaurant called Olympia, Olympic, something like that. And they got the Olympic rings as their logo. And rather, Van Auk and IOC came and said, you got to take that down, you got to cover it up, something like that. And they, rather than saying yes, they resisted it. They fought back. They threw lawyers back at them. One little lawyer back against their throng of lawyers. And they said that... that the COC, the Canadian Olympic Committee, is the keeper of the rings within, like, they have to enforce the rules about the rings and the trademarks within the country during that time. And that restaurant's been there for 20, 30 years, and they've never had a complaint with Canadian Olympic Association or whatever they're called. And so that was their reasoning. They said, how come you're just selectively enforcing it now when we've done this forever? And so they're gonna not expand it. They're not gonna advertise with the rings. We're that place with the rings on the thing, but they're gonna end up keeping that up there. And at least they're gonna push the limit and see what they can accomplish. So there's a lot of people whose livelihood is really dependent on these onerous laws as well.
Well, why don't we go to another commercial break, and we'll be back with a bit more about the Olympics on Radio Freethinker.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
CITR 101.9 presents the Ice Cream Social at the Pit Pub.
Ice Cream Social, your favorite weekly night of 50s and 60s dance tunes, is coming to UBC.
CITR DJs Tyler Fedchuk and Cam Dales will be down at the Pit Pub on Thursday, January 28th from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. with cool tunes and sweet deals on drinks.
Support your independent campus radio station by coming down to the Pit and partying with us.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker talking about the Olympics. So why don't we talk a bit about the media and the Olympics? So what is the media doing with the Olympics?
Well, the media is divided into a whole bunch of different buckets when it comes to the Olympics. The first big category is the rights-holding media, and they'll be the only ones that have access to that shiny new Canada Place Part 2 with the grassy roof. I thought with the grassy roof, I thought they'd let me play disc golf up there or something, but it turns out those are only the host broadcasters, one from each country, who pays the big money. And in Canada's case, is the first time it's CTV rather than CBC, the coverage. They doubled CBC's usual bid. It's a blind bid process, so they'll be doing the coverage. But that's, you know, the esteemed mainstream media that will be in there. Then there's a whole other facility for kind of the second tier media, and this is run by the provincial secretariat for the Olympics, and this is the BC International Media Center at Robson Square. And they've actually accredited some grassroots bloggers and just regular folks who have a little bit of a following and have a proven track record. But it's really designed more to bring economic stimulus to British Columbia, because those second tier reporters can't report any kind of, like, here's the scores of the games within 24 hours. Like, there's a lot of limits on what they can say. So it's going to be more like, you know, we make wine here in British Columbia. Why don't we have a wine tasting? Why don't you try these fabulous cheeses from here in British Columbia, and some of these other kind of tourism-related issues? And then there's all these other people. And what I mean by them is people who are maybe coming from a small-town newspaper, and they're coming just to kind of see what there is. There's people just like me coming from Latvia, Lithuania, and Venezuela who just are grassroots media makers that love to tell stories online. You know, in Salt Lake City, I covered... I went to 28 events in 13 days, which I think I should have got a medal for just doing that, especially considering the amount of beer I drank. But there's all these other people who just want to document their experience beyond putting a little photo album to show to their friends. Now, this will be the first Olympics where social media, for lack of a better term, these web publishing tools are in full effect. And so there's all these other people that aren't part of those first two groups that want to be telling these stories, but are, again, a little bit confused on what they can and can't do. When they're inside an event, they're a regular spectator, and they can create pictures or write a blog post. Today I went to the hockey game, and here's a picture of me. But running a video clip of the game, well, on you can't do that. Although there's going to be people showing up like, oh my goodness, my phone has a video camera on, I'm going to do this. And then the person next to him goes, you know, you can put that right on Ustream.com or whatever. And And so it's going to kind of cause some confusion. But outside of the private space inside the venues, there's all these other stories that people are trying to get out because the world's attention is going to be on Vancouver. You know, there's obviously a tremendous amount of civic concerns, you know, from homelessness to, this lack of transparency about the budgets and stuff that people want to talk about. So there's a few different facilities of sort of and movements or campaigns that have popped up around town. There's going to be a center here at UBC and some groups of people kind of running a little media center here at UBC. Of course, UBC is one of the venues for hockey. And then W2, the Woodward Space downtown, they're going to be hosting more kind of community media, a lot of the alternative media that's based here in Vancouver, and also going to be the headquarters for the Legal Observers Program. So that could get a little bit heavy down there. There'll certainly be some interesting stuff to report there. And then there's a bunch of these other places just kind of opening up their doors to media makers. For my part, what I've done is a couple of years ago, I put together this little campaign called True North Media House and started educating at least, you know, from my point of view, whether people are coming to celebrate, to protest, or that huge gray area in between where they're like, well, I don't love everything about the Olympics, but dang it, I sure love curling. All those people should have the right to tell their stories and know the best way to do them. And by working together and learning about them, you can actually get an audience for these stories. Because it's one thing to write your little curling blog for four people. It's a lot more to write a curling and the impact on Vancouver and you put it out there and all of a sudden it's 40,000 or 4 million people looking at it. And I saw this firsthand from Salt Lake again, where I put up a little 15-second digital video clip. This was 02, you know, that we didn't quite have the technology back then, kids.
That was before YouTube, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Of the first ever winter Olympian from Nepal. And you think, Nepal, you know, winter. But there's no Sherping event in the Winter Olympics, but they had a cross-country skier, and I've shot this little video clip, and it went bananas because back in Nepal, they had no idea. There's no coverage. There was no, like, just gather around the TV and watch our skier. So just being able to tell those long tail of the stories, whether it's about the sports, all these arts and culture things, there's this huge opportunity for us as regular folks to create the people's history of the Olympics, for lack of a better term, to tell the real story besides the stuff that's going to be on CTV, which will be people winning gold medals, people who are in scandals, or people who are particularly attractive. They'll be on the mainstream media. Everything else, it's ours kind of ability and responsibility almost to tell the story just as regular people, the way that we see our city and our environment changing.
I can't help but think that VanOck and the IOC really missed a big opportunity to sort of embrace that grassroots movement.
Gosh, I couldn't agree with you more. And in fact, I started this whole thing with an open letter to VanOck. Dear VanOck, we're local. We would love to help out. Will you deputize us? Get us involved. The company I was working for when I started this campaign, Rain City Studios, was selected as official web blog vendor for the Olympics, which turned out meant absolutely nothing. I had dreams of the Latvian bobsled team saying, hey, we need a blog. Can you help us? It would have been great. But we got a canned response. My letter got passed around VanOck, as I learned later. And one gentleman, Graham Menzies, had the honor of replying to me, which was basically like, thanks for your note. Go have a great Olympics. I hope you have fun making your social media. Kids, go get them. But just a few months ago, just before the climate change in Copenhagen, the IOC had they do a big congress, big summit kind of thing. And they do it every 6 years. And so the last time they had it, social media wasn't a term, right? This time they got a schooling, an ad man from the UK went up there and gave him a talk called The Digital Revolution and told the IOC that they're at risk of becoming irrelevant to a whole generation. They got to loosen up intellectual property laws, encourage people to share content, start using the YouTubes and the Facebooks and the Twitters and all that kind of stuff. John Furlong, the CEO of VanOck, came out and said, wow, social media, huh? That totally wasn't on our radar. And they kind of got a little bit of an effort going, but I think that they, especially with Vancouver being a real hub for all these new media companies in an industry that I work in, they really missed a huge opportunity to deputize, encourage, and amplify the coverage that the regular folks are using.
It seems like they got all caught up in getting like as big of sponsorship deals and stuff and getting the like biggest networks to bid as much money as possible. And they didn't realize the fact that like media is moving away from these people. Yeah. And sure, like the small guys can't give out as much money, but it might bring more people, more interest, which might lead to more money in the end.
I mean, can you even imagine if they even had like a couple of Olympic athletes have official Twitter accounts? Well,
that's
huge.
That's really ridiculous because I know a lot of major sports leagues now like ask their athletes to do that kind of stuff. You know, the Canucks have them. I'm sure that most sporting leagues have. You know, they make their players blog or Twitter or something. So it is.
They don't even have to write them themselves.
No, it's really
have someone in their entourage do it.
It's really ridiculous when you think about it that they're missing out on a really cool opportunity to promote their brand, right? I mean,
well, the Olympics have gone back and forth about what they'll allow athletes to do in the social media space. In 1998 in Nagano, when there was websites were still a new thing, they were actually encouraging athletes to keep a journal and we'll put it online for you. Then by the time they got to Torino, they were doing takedowns of athletes who were blogging about stuff that that the IOC considered to be journalistic. Now they've come on. Just a few months ago, they said that athletes can blog, but it has to be for personal expression only and can't have anything that looks journalistic at all. And this includes everyone who's part of the accredited Olympic family, quotation marks, which is the athletes, their families, anyone who gets, you're going to see everyone walking around the next few weeks is going to have some different kind of laminate badge on. So the people who are anything official with IOC and VANOC, they're obliged to follow these codes of conduct, which mean that they cannot act as reporters. Now, does that mean that they can take a picture of them and someone that they met backstage before an event, me and Apollo Anton Ono, and put up on their Facebook? Is that reportage? Probably not. But if then that picture runs in a magazine, well, then that's probably reported. So it's going to be interesting to see where that demarcation line is drawn.
In most games, like when the athletes are coming out in the opening or closing ceremonies, yeah, they're always holding little cameras.
Yeah,
and
you
stuff.
Saw this in Beijing.
Yeah. If they like decide to post that video on YouTube, do you think it's probably going to get a takedown? Because that would be cool to see, like, from the athlete's perspective, like, all like the thousands of people in the crowd cheering them on, like, from that ground level perspective.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a really interesting thing. As soon as I saw that in Beijing, like, what's to stop one of those athletes from uploading it real time to a streaming service? The only thing that's doing that is they've signed a piece of paper saying that they won't do it. But if you're, you know, come on. Like, what are they going to do? Take away your gold medal?
I wouldn't put it past them, actually.
I think it would be really bad press for them if they sued one of their own athletes.
But, it is pretty ridiculous. I mean, we've been on the show many times talking about how important it is to have free access to information. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't understand why a sporting event would not want to expose their product to as many people as possible. It's ridiculous. It's
mind-boggling. A Byzantine idea of control over intellectual property?
Well, yeah. Again, I'll go back to what I was saying before. I mean, it's not about the sports. What are you guys, silly?
Yeah, it's about selling rights.
It's the commercialization. And what they're protecting is, of course, exclusive rights to X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. So who cares about the athletes? I mean, it's all about Coke.
Without getting into this too much, this is one of the reasons why intellectual property rights need to be looked at.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
a no whole other show.
But I think one of the things that will come out of Vancouver and these experiments, I mean, these exact lines that we're talking about right now, London and Sochi, the next two Olympics, will really get the benefit of that. And London has a director of social media who's out there evangelizing, encouraging people. And what with the economic recession and all that, they've scaled down their whole press center and all their stuff and are now talking a strategy of encouraging people to do that. The guy who's running the Russia Sochi games is he's Twittering and he's on the internets and he's got his little BlackBerry and all that. And so I think you're going to see some big changes after Vancouver, which is a little annoying because, come on, man, it's Vancouver.
Vancouver's huge for social media.
Yeah. And we're used to going out there and telling these stories. And again, it's a bit of a lost opportunity, which with Mayor Greger saying he wants to attract green and technology and new media kind of companies. It's like, well, we're here. Could you help us out a little bit?
It's like the city of Vancouver goes, you know, open source, open data, and everyone else decides to clamp down and shut down everything.
Yeah.
Well, so I guess there are some serious issues for the Olympics. Let's just quickly here, because we're running out of time, but let's get some predictions here. Is Vancouver going to descend into an Orwellian police state?
Probably not. I don't think so.
Okay.
The cameras will stick around. They'll use them for, you know, whatever they've been using them for. Hopefully, someone will convince them that they should make the rights of who gets to do what with the data more publicly available and transparent, but we'll see.
I predict that the cameras will stick around, but will become a political issue in the next provincial election and will become a pawn for politicians to tease us with taking them away, like they did with Photo Radar.
That holds for almost anything, man.
I don't know. Like, if you take the UK as an example, the cameras are actually generally a positive thing for politicians, sadly. Like,
well, that's the UK.
Well, I mean...
we know about them.
When it comes down to it, though, I don't think the general public is as anti-cameras as some people like us, well, at least me, and some people here are.
Well, I think we were going with that. I mean, it's the whole idea of the politics of fear, right? And I mean, cameras help everyone think, oh, the cameras are there, I've got something to be worried about. Whether there is or isn't, it creates that climate, and politicians love doing that. Now, my prediction is in the next year, you're going to have something like the Downtown East Side group or whatever are going to get harassed based on video footage of protests or something they've done that's going to be captured on these CCTV cameras, and that's going to become a big thing. And then a year after that, they're going to come down because an officer is going to get caught doing something he shouldn't be doing.
Yes.
On one of these CCTVs, and that's going to be embarrassing. Then they'll take them down.
But okay. See, here's the thing, though. The problem about the cameras not being very open is, like, especially if the police are controlling them, do you really think they're going to, like... Oh, if, say, like, they're the only ones who see, like, an incident, like, no one else has good evidence, like, do you really think they're going to outwardly try and, like, go after their own officers? Like, this is why these cameras
they haven't
to be
done
open.
It in the past.
Yeah, they really should be open, because if these cameras capture the police beating some guy in the face, not that that would ever happen here in Vancouver, will someone be able to use that in their defense or to fight the police? How do we get access? Is it covered under a freedom of information thing? Who knows? But I think that the cameras will stick around, but it's going to encourage a public dialogue that will encourage an increased understanding of this differentiating between public and private space and how that's changed. So harken back to a little bit of the concerns about how Expo was going to change Vancouver. But I think that it will encourage the laws to become more liberal about how we get access to this information and how we together own the public space. I hope so, anyway.
Well, I hope our listeners have some predictions and thoughts. And if you guys want to tell us, you know, who's going to win the gold medal, you can tell us that too. Or you can just tell us sport, which is coming up next. But if you have an opinion, you can email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. And, well, we're getting down there in time. Do we have some events or promotions we can promote for people?
Well, I just found out about this today because it's happening right now at UBC. It's the third annual Resisting the University Conference, Rethinking the Olympics. And it's happening from January 26th today to the 28th. And they are holding a whole bunch of panels and workshops on various civil rights issues and protest issues associated with the Olympics. So probably the most interesting thing that people who have been just listening to this show right now could go see is the Know Your Rights workshop, which is from 1 to 2 p.m. in the sub right here on January 27th, where basically they're just going to talk about, you know, what your rights are as regards to protesting or doing anything around the Olympics. That's the sub 211.
And if you want to like look at all the events they're hosting, go to www.resistubc.com.
Mm-hmm. During the Olympics, I'm going to, through this True North Media House project, I'm going to be organizing a bunch of little photo walks, field trips, and out and abouts to invite people who are like us, coming in from other countries, who want to do something more with their Olympics, to explore parts of Vancouver that aren't on the north, beyond Stanley Park and Granville Island, including forays out to the Surrey Live site to see what that's like. There's some culture out there. And as well as all kinds of other hospitality houses, which is really the secret hidden fun thing about the Olympics. A lot of countries come in and they rent out bars and warehouses and empty spaces will all be, you know, hospitality houses run by other countries, which are a great opportunity. And for all the cynicism about the Olympics and all these conundrums that we've talked about, and since we taxpayers are foot in this bill, I do encourage people to go out and find some fun to get into, find some international people, because beyond all these conundrums, there is something really special. That sounds kind of a single tier special. When you hang out with someone from another country and you might not have the ability to communicate with words too much, but you find a little something, whether it's you're out there taking pictures or you're out there having a pint, I plan to be out there sharing that with people. And then if you don't make it to these panels, I've assembled a huge dossier of different reporters, kind of social reporter specific resources on TrueNorthMediaHouse.com, including original links to all the original laws that we've been talking about, these bylaws and federal legislation, commentary from a bunch of different people that we've interviewed and talked to about their opinion of what you can and can't do. So it's a great place for to get started to kind of educate yourself on some of these media specific issues.
Well, that sounds like a great resource.
It's going to be a hard one to follow up. I only have a short one. Actually, this is a heads up. Gwyn Dwyer, who is a reporter and author, he wrote a book called War, which is a great analysis of how war has developed over time. But more recently, he's done Climate Wars, which is basically economics warfare between that. Anyhow, he's going to be in town. He's going to be at the Vancouver Community Center on Tuesday, February 2nd at 7:30 in their public space, in their 155 East Broadway. It's free admission, so I'd recommend anyone showing up for that.
He's a really important writer, I think, and it's one of the few reasons I still pick up the Georgia Strait, because they run his.
That and what's going on in town is the only thing that I think, because we know how much we love the Georgia Strait here.
Yeah.
And cutting edge scientific, in quotes.
And the UBC Freethinkers are joining up with Campus for Christ to host interfaith dialogues this Thursday at 5. I stupidly forgot to write down the room, but if you search for UBC Freethinkers on UBC Freethinkers on Facebook, you will find the event and all the information there, the room number.
Okay. Well, I have two recommendations. They're kind of a little bit different. They're actually movies, and you might have heard of a movie called Creation. And it's the story of Charles Darwin writing The Origin of the Species. And stars
Some guy.
And Jennifer Connelly.
It also stars... He's the guy who played the albino monk on the Dan Brown...
Oh, God.
...Da Vinci Code.
No, he wasn't.
he was in Heroes.
Well, anyway...
And he was an actor.
Yeah.
He's
a good actor.
I watched it. I thought it was pretty good. It takes a few creative licenses with Darwin's story, but if you're a fan of evolution and Darwin, you're going to like it. If you're just coming into the story, might want to go with maybe something by, like, PBS, because it's a bit dry at times.
Are Darwin's finches in there?
There are finches, yes. There's also foxes and bunny rabbits. And
played
one
by
of them
other various
the other one.
Actors who appeared in Heroes.
The other movie I'd like to recommend, a bit lighter fare, is by a good pal, Ricky Gervais. And he made a movie called The Invention of Lying, which is actually quite interesting because if you remember the promos for that, it was about a guy who invents lying. What the promos didn't tell you about is what he invents by lying. So I don't want to spoil it, but check it out. I think that if you're a skeptic or maybe if you're an atheist, you might be interested in that movie. It has some interesting lessons to teach in that one.
Is it religion?
Maybe it's religion.
Spoiler alert.
Speaking of interesting things, as you guys hear too, with the we did a plug last week for Haiti and how people should, you know, try and help out in that. And it turns out that our Scientology friends have also done a thing. John Travolta has taken his personal private Boeing 747. Why he needs a 747, I don't know.
Well, but obviously to crash it into the volcanoes full of ghosts.
Yeah.
but he's loaded up with supplies, but a whole bunch of Scientology quote-unquote healers to go down and tell everyone in Haiti that there was no earthquake. It's merely thetans that are causing you problems. No, he's going down there and he's going to help out. But he's going to be proselytizing the Scientology, which I think is a little... icky, although I guess he's not the only religion to be doing that, but...
No, I guess I'll save my $10 that I was going to send down because John's got it covered.
Well, I think that if you are interested in looking for sort of secular, you know, science-based ways of helping Haiti, I'm sure, you know, you could try the Red Cross or...
Doctors Without Borders.
And do look up Richard Dawkins. He has set up a system that you can donate through, which he covers all the administrative costs. And so your money goes directly to Doctors Without
Borders. And as we said last time, I believe, if you are going to donate without it earmarked for Haiti, just in case, like, so they have, like, just in case they don't need it for use Haiti, it. They have it for other things as well, not just sitting there.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I have one more thing that I completely forgot to mention. We mentioned this last time, but it's tomorrow. It's the it's a panel with UBC astronomy and physics profs asking whoever wants to show up what they think astronomers should explore next in space. It's happening at Coach House in Green College tomorrow, which is Wednesday, at 7:30.
That'll be a good precursor because we plan to do a show on space exploration and all that. And on that note, if anyone out there has any events or anything that they want the word to get out on, please contact us at
radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
And check out our website at radiofreethinker.com. I'm hoping at some point during the next couple of weeks to put up a calendar there so that we can put all our events up on there.
And you should also check out our Facebook fan page on Facebook. So become a fan and make your friends become fans too, or you'll disown them.
And we're pretty much out of time right now, so thanks very much to our special guest, Dave Olson, for coming in to talk with us about the Olympics.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, and if you're not bored of my shtick, you can find me on all sorts of other podcasts. Just go look at chugalon.com and get yourself subscribed. And for spreading these messages, do consider using hootsuite.com. There's my shameless plug.
Awesome. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Dave O saying chugalon.
This is Daniel saying thanks for listening.
And this is Rob saying have a good evening.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces. All in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.